Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome decree, where Alf, the sacred river, ran through caverns measureless to man down to a sunless sea. So, thrice 5 miles of fertile ground with walls and towers were girdled round, and there were gardens, bright with sinuous rills, where blossomed many an incense-bearing tree, and here were forests, ancient as the hills, enfolding sunny spots of greenery. But oh, that deep romantic chasm which slanted down the green hill athwart a cedarn cover. A savage place, as holy and enchanted as e'er beneath a waning moon was haunted by woman wailing for her demon lover. And from this chasm, in ceaseless turmoil seething, as if this earth in fast, thick pants were breathing, a mighty fountain momently was forced, amidst whose swift, half-intermitted bursts, huge fragments vaulted like resounding hail or chaffy grain beneath the thresher's flail. And midst these dancing rocks at once and ever it flung up momently the sacred river. 5 miles meandering with a mazy motion through wood and dale the sacred river ran, then reached the caverns measureless to man, and sank in tumult to a lifeless ocean. And midst this tumult, Kubla heard from far ancestral voices prophesying war. The shadow of the dome of pleasure floated midway on the waves, where was heard the mingled measure from the fountain and the caves. It was a miracle of rare device, a sunny pleasure dome with caves of ice. A damsel with a dulcimer in a vision once I saw. It was an Abyssinian maid, and on her dulcimer she played, singing of Mount Abora. Could I revive within me her symphony and song, to such a deep delight 'twould win me, that with music loud and long I would build that dome in air, that sunny dome, those caves of ice, and all who heard should see them there, and all should cry, beware, beware, his flashing eyes, his floating hair. Weave a circle round him thrice, and close your eyes with holy dread, for he on honeydew has fed and drunk the milk of paradise. Ladies and gentlemen, if all is working, this is the Ask Dr. Hal Show, live on radio. Yes, dear fiends, it would be helpful if someone would say on the chatterbox that this program is audible. Otherwise, I fear it may all simply go down the memory hole, which has happened on unfortunate occasions in the past. Quite vexing when one has a show to do, but part of the careful steersmanship one must execute here on Radio Valencia. One must guide one's frail vessel between the rocks and not capsize and be devoured by sea monsters. At least you can stuff wax in your ears and not hear the ululation of the sirens that drives men mad. But you might want to hear them, after all. In which case, we recommend lashing yourself to the mast and instructing the sailors with their earwax intact, not to let you loose, no matter what you say or how you beg. So then, as I said, you won't be driven mad, you'll only be devoured by sea monsters. But there is a third way, and that is simply to sit back, relax, and enjoy our feature presentation here on Radio Valencia. You know, dear fiends, Radio Valencia has been in business for quite some time now. It has been 14 years since the Anabasis from the former Pirate Cat Radio, when Radio Valencia first hung up its shingle, first in Chicken John's late lamented warehouse, then at our shabby but comfortable studio on 20th Street and Mission, and ever since then, here on 22nd Street, between Valencia and Mission. To commemorate the existence of this enterprise, there will be a party to which all are invited on Sunday. Sunday happens to be the anniversary, the 14th anniversary of the inception of Radio Valencia, and this party will be held at the Knockout, where I, Dr. Howland Owl, used to perform a weekly show many years ago when it was called The Odeon. But the Knockout is friendly to enterprises such as ours. Where is the Knockout? Did you know that Valencia and Mission actually intersect? They do. And where they do, they're pointing directly at the Knockout on the other side of the street, distinguished by its sign, which shows a Mexican luchadora. Yes, that is the place. And so if you wish to raise a convivial glass with some of your favorite Radio Valencia people, Sunday night would be the time to do it. As for when on Sunday night, I rather suspect the entire night will be given over to such roisterings. Yes, it's true, there will be no strict observance of time there. But oh, what fun it was back when it was the Odeon. Then we did the Ask Dr. Hal show, live version, and the audience asked questions, and K-Rob provided very special effects. Those days will not return. Ever since Chicken John was canceled by the holier-than-thou crowd, who have been so inconsiderate as to make death threats against his children if he does a show again. And of course, the only show that he did with any regularity was mine, the Ask Dr. Hal show. This radio program is a succedaneum of that show. But it does have a signal drawback, and that is, you can't really ask Dr. Hal anything because the studio phone here does not work. There can be no speech back and forth. What can happen is, if you're on the chatterbox, you can pose a question, and if I happen to see it, I may happen to answer it. Not that I expect that. The spirit of interactivity is long flown. Last week, K-Rob came in and visited us around midnight. I have not been in communication with K-Rob, but if he does appear, it will probably be around that time. However, I think it unlikely that we will have K-Rob visiting since he has gone on to woods and pastures new. He's left behind this Radio Valencia and started his own station. You may have heard of it. It's called Relodio. And there, puzzling evidence, K-Rob, occasionally Michael Pepe, and Sarah Z all hold forth, and among them sits me. I am one of that crowd, and our show, if it is not canceled by some convulsion of a confluence of events or an accident of nature or an act of God or the devil, if this show does happen, it will be tomorrow night. Sort of, kind of, generally starting in the vicinity of 10 o'clock. There is no radio regularity. There is no signing in to the station. There is no pushing a red button to come in and a blue button to come out. All of those things here at Radio Valencia we must observe. No, it is organic. It flows into being, and eventually it flows out of being, and at that time I've usually fallen asleep. Yes, I fall asleep. I am old, and after so many puffs of smoke and so much ingestion of curious substances provided by K-Rob, often consciousness flitters away like a bat at close of eve that has left the brain that won't believe. Still, we often have a merry time there, and check us out tomorrow if, as I say, it hasn't been canceled. What a word, canceled. As if a huge stamp saying no has been dropped over the proceedings. One cannot know the circumstances. Only that there will be no show. But, dear fiends, I, Dr. Howland Owl, will be at Burning Man as soon as I figure out who I'm going with. Anyone going who would like to travel with me, I'm really good for gas money, and I know some lovely people on the way that we can visit. But so far, I haven't got it figured out. I'm going to be in art car camp. I know, I don't even have a car, but they want me there, and I'll be in a rotting trailer that Flash has kindly provided. Art Car Camp is not near Rod's Road anymore. In fact, Rod's Road no longer exists. But Art Car Camp will be back from the Esplanade by at least 3 blocks. I need to figure out exactly where it is so I can join my bosom friends there. And then, I will be ready for the show I do there every year, the People's Fashion Show. This year we've had to change the date again. How I hate to change the date. For decades it was the same date. It was always Saturday, the day of the burn, at 5:30. But some pointed out that, you know, there are plans for the burn that don't include going to some By Our Lady show. And 5:30, the sun is still up hot and burning in the heavens. You don't want to trudge through the dust to Center Camp Cafe, or whatever it is called now. It's no longer a cafe. Let's just say Center Camp, that big pavilion. That's where the show still is. But you don't want to go there in your heavy costume or whatever you're wearing. You can be absolutely naked if you want. There's an entire spectrum of outfits with which our participants are fitted out. This year, we have changed it. We've put it forward to Wednesday. Why Wednesday? It has been changed to Thursday in recent years. And Thursday was very good because Thursday was 7:30 at night when it's cool. And it's not at the same time as the burn. And so you could organize going there. And it's worked very well for us. But there's the cacophony cocktail party. Yes. Danger Ranger will helm the cacophony cocktail party in Center Camp. And even though they no longer sell coffee or lemonade or anything there, there will be a full bar. And you can expect to see many of the muckety-mucks and panjandrums of Burning Man there dressed in their finery. That's why we moved our show there, because we'll have a ready-made crowd ready to see the show and maybe be the show. Anyone who is there can get up on our stage and join me and DJ Justin Credible as we put on the old same show, the longest running event on the Playa, never interrupted yet. Just go backstage and our comely assistants will arrange for you to stand on the ramp that carries you up to the stage. And then when you're on the stage, you can walk across while I, Dr. Howland Owl, greet you, and Justin Credible also converses mellifluously with you. If you wish, you can go down the stairs in the front of the stage and walk into the audience, where we will clear a space. Yes, in the past we had a runway. Now Burning Man seems to have lost the runway. But who needs a runway when we pull all the furniture to one side or the other, and you can go down and walk among them in your outfit or your birthday suit, whatever you choose. There have been unusual costume decisions made in the past, and we hope that you, if you're at Burning Man, will participate in this event. If you don't feel like it, you can still get up to the bar, which will offer all sorts of drinks, and then sit in the audience and heckle or applaud as the occasion seems to suggest. Yes, that's about the size of it. I repeat, if anyone wants to go with me to Burning Man, get in touch through the usual channels. I've traveled with many people. In fact, it seems that every year I go with different people. I never go with the same people. Perhaps I'll go with Chicken again this year. The theme of Burning Man is curiouser and curiouser, which, as you may recognize, is a quotation from Alice's Adventures Underground, a.k.a. Alice in Wonderland, by Charles Lutwidge Dodgson. It is an interjection made by Alice when she encounters the bizarre nature of Wonderland. And you may find the Wonderland of Burning Man to be curiouser and yet still curiouser. So if you're interested in taking that bite of the mushroom, which may make you tall or small or reduce you to nothing at all, Center Camp will lie open, and you can see us do a flopperoo or succeed magnificently as we do our show. So, there. No. I never said there would be no Relodio. Of course, there may be no Relodio, but it hasn't gotten to me. I'm fully expecting that there will be Relodio. Yes, you will simply have to see. Tune in that night, and, it'll either be there or it won't. It is binary in that way. I don't run it. I'm just on it. periodically, and having traveled afar, I came back 2 weeks ago on a Friday, but I was too tired to do a show, and I'd already put up a rerun here. Then the next Friday, I did a lengthy show, and now Friday has rolled round again. So I'm going to do a show of a certain length. If K-Rob doesn't show up, I'll probably close down around 1. I've got a million things to do. And when you're up late at night, as enjoyable as that may be, then there is the drag of having to get up the next day, a considerable one. I have been working on art projects, but I need to work on projects of my own while there is still time. Time for you, and time for me, and time yet for 100 indecisions, and for 100 visions and revisions before the taking of a toast and tea. All right, everybody, all right. What we're going to do now is something I have been asked to do before. In the past, I have read many of the esoteric and bizarre stories of Clark Ashton Smith. Tonight, since it has been suggested, I am going to do one of his most mordant stories, The Dark Eidolon. The Dark Eidolon takes place on the last continent of Earth, Zothik, far in the future, when the sun is an immense crimson orb filling half the heavens, and when evils of the prime have returned to bedevil the human race. There are future versions of familiar demons. Even Satan, who we think of as the Prince of Evil, or Iblis, whatever you want to call him, has been replaced in that future time by the Dark Lord Thassidon, who you will hear more of in the piece I am about to do, which is called, as I believe I already said, The Dark Eidolon. Of course, we will be interrupted by thumping from 1970s disco music. There's no way it can't be. In order to run the music, I have to have the guest microphone wide open. The wall is uninsulated. You may hear the village people. It's a terrible thing when you're trying to set a mood to be beset by such layerings of semi-obsolescent piffle. But, on the other hand, I'll let it be a challenge to me. So let us prepare for the Dark Eidolon. About Zothik, Smith wrote this poem. He who has trod the shadows of Zothik and looked upon the cool red sun oblique, henceforth returns to no anterior land, but haunts a latter coast where cities crumble in the black sea sand and dead gods drink the brine. He who has known the gardens of Zothik, where bleed the fruits torn by the Simorgh's beak, savors no fruit of greener hemispheres. In arbors uttermost, in sunset cycles of the sombering years, he sips an aromanth wine. He who has loved the wild girls of Zothik shall come not back a gentler love to seek, nor know the vampires from the lover's kiss. For him the scarlet ghost of Lilith from time's last necropolis rears amorous and malign. He who has sailed in galleys of Zothique and seen the looming of strange spire and peak must face again the sorcerer sent typhoon and take the steerer's post on far-poured oceans by the shifted moon or the reshapen sign. Now to the tale of the Dark Eidolon. Zothique, the last continent of Earth, the sun no longer shone with the whiteness of its prime, but was dim and tarnished as if with a vapor of blood. New stars without number had declared themselves in the heavens, and the shadows of the infinite had fallen closer, and out of the shadows the older gods had returned to man, the gods forgotten since Hyperborea, since Mu and Poseidonis, bearing other names but the same attributes. And the elder demons had also returned, battening on the fumes of evil sacrifice and fostering again the primordial sorceries. Many were necromancers and magicians of Zothique, and the infamy and marvel of their doings were legended everywhere in the latter days. But among them all, there was none greater than Namira, who imposed his black yoke on the cities of Xylac, and later, in a proud delirium, deemed himself the veritable peer of Thassydon, Lord of Evil. Namira had built his abode in Umaos, the chief town of Xylac, to which he came from the desert realm of Tasun, with the dark renown of his thaumaturgies like a cloud of desert storm behind him. And no man knew that in coming to Umaos, he returned to the city of his birth, for all deemed him a native of Tasun. Indeed, none could have dreamt that the great sorcerer was one with the beggar boy Narthos, an orphan of questionable parentage, who had begged his daily bread in the streets and bazaars of Umaos. Wretchedly had he lived, alone and despised, and a hatred of the cruel, opulent city grew in his heart like a smothered flame that feeds in secret, hiding the time when it shall become a conflagration consuming all things. Bitterer always, through his boyhood and early youth, was the spleen and rancor of Narthos toward men. And one day, the prince, Zotulla, a boy but little older than he, riding a restive palfrey, came upon him in the square before the imperial palace, and Narthos implored an alms. But Zotulla, scorning his plea, rode arrogantly forward. spurring the palfrey, and Narthos was ridden down and trampled under its hooves. And afterwards, nigh to death from the trampling, he lay senseless for many hours, while the people passed him by unheeding, and at last, regaining his senses, he dragged himself to his hovel, but he limped a little thereafter all his days, and the mark of one hoof remained like a brand on his body, fading never. Later, he left Umaos and was forgotten quickly by its people. Going southward into Tasuun, he lost his way in the great desert and was near to perishing. But finally, he came to a small oasis where dwelt the wizard Ufalok, a hermit who preferred the company of honest jackals and hyenas to that of men. And Ufalok, seeing the great craft and evil in the starveling boy, gave succor to Narthos and sheltered him. He dwelt for years with Ufalok, becoming the wizard's pupil and the heir of his demon-rested lore. Strange things he learned in that hermitage, being fed on fruits and grain that had sprung not from the watered earth, and wine that was not the juice of Terrene grapes. And like Ufalok, he became a master in devildom, and drove his own bond with the archfiend Thasaidon. When Ufalok died, he took the name of Namirha, and went forth as a mighty sorcerer among the wandering peoples and the deep-buried mummies of Tasuun. But never could he forget the miseries of his boyhood in Umaos, and the wrong he had endured from Zotoa. And year by year, he spun over in his thoughts the black web of revenge. And his fame grew ever darker and faster, and men feared him in remote lands beyond Tasuun. With bated whispers, they spoke of his deeds in the cities of Yoros, and in Zulbachsire, the abode of the ghoulish deity Mordigian. And long before the coming of Namirha himself, the people of Umaos knew him as a fabled scourge that was direr than Simoom or Pestilence. Now, in the years that followed the going forth of the boy Narthos from Umaos, Pithalm, the father of Prince Zotulla, was slain by the sting of a small adder that had crept into his bed for warmth on an autumn night. Some said that the adder had been purveyed by Zotulla, but this was a thing that no man could verily affirm. After the death of Pithaim, Zotulla, being his only son, was emperor of Xylac and ruled evilly from his throne in Imaos. Indolent he was, and tyrannic, and full of strange luxuries and cruelties. But the people, who were also evil, acclaimed him in his turpitude. So he prospered, and the lords of hell and heaven smote him not. And the red suns and ashen moons went westward over Xylac, falling into that seldom voyaged sea, which, if the mariner's tales were true, poured evermore like a swiftening river past the infamous Isle of Na'at, and fell in a worldwide cataract upon nether space from the far sheer edge of earth. Grosser still he grew, and his sins were as overswollen fruits that ripen above a deep abyss. But the winds of time blew softly, and the fruits fell not. And Zotulla laughed amid his fools and his eunuchs and his lemans, and the tale of his luxuries was borne afar, and was told by dim outland peoples as a twin marvel with the bruited necromancies of Namirha. In It came to pass, in the year of the hyena and the month of the star Caniculae, that a great feast was given by Zotulla to the inhabitants of Umaos, meats that had been cooked in exotic spices from Sotar, Isle of the East, were spread everywhere, and the ardent wines of Yoros and Xylac, filled as with subterranean fires, were poured inexhaustibly from huge urns for all. The wines awoke a furious mirth and a royal madness, and afterward they brought a slumber no less profound than the Lethe of the tomb. And one by one, as they drank, the revelers fell down in the streets, the houses and gardens, as if a plague had struck them. And Zotulla slept in his banquet hall of gold and ebony, with his odalisks and chamberlains about him. So, in all Umaos, there was no man or woman wakeful at the hour when Sirius began to fall toward the west. Thus it was that none saw or heard the coming of Namira. But awakening heavily in the latter forenoon, the Emperor Zotulla heard a confused babble, a troublous clamor of voices from such of his eunuchs and women as had awakened before him. Inquiring the cause, he was told that a strange prodigy had occurred during the night. But being still bemused with wine and slumber, he comprehended little enough of its nature till his favorite concubine, Obexa, led him to the eastern portico of the palace from which he could behold the marvel with his own eyes. Now, the palace stood alone at the center of Umaos, and to north, west, and south, for wide intervals of distance, there stretched the imperial gardens, full of superbly arching palms and loftily spiring fountains. But to eastward was a broad open area used as a sort of common between the palace and the mansions of high optimates. In this space, which had lain wholly vacant at eve, a building towered colossal and lordly beneath the full-risen sun, with domes like monstrous fungi of stone that had come up in the night. And the domes, rearing level with those of Zotulla, were builded of death-white marble, and the huge facade, with multi-columned porticos and deep balconies, was wrought in alternate zones of night-black onyx and porphyry, hued as with dragon's blood. And Zotulla swore lewdly, calling with hoarse blasphemies on the gods and devils of Xylac. And great was his dumbfoundment, deeming the marvel a work of wizardry. The women gathered about him, crying out with shrill cries of awe and terror, and more of his courtiers, awakening, came to swell the hubbub, and the fat castrados dittered in their cloth of gold like immense black jellies in golden basins. But Zotulla, mindful of his dominion as emperor of all Xylac, sought to conceal his own trepidation, saying, "Now who is this that has presumed to enter Umaos like a jackal in the dark and has made impious den in proximity and counterview with my palace? Go forth and inquire the miscreant's name, but ere you go, instruct the headsman to make sharp his double-handed sword." Then, fearing the emperor's wrath, if they tarried, certain of the chamberlains went forth unwillingly and approached the portals of the strange edifice. It seemed that the portals were deserted till they drew near. And then, on the threshold, there appeared appeared a titanic skeleton, taller than any man of Earth, and it strode forward to meet them with ell-long strides. The skeleton was swathed in a loincloth of scarlet silk, with a buckle of jet, and it wore a black turban, starred with diamonds, whose topmost foldings nearly touched the high lintel. Eyes like flickering marsh fires burned in its deep eye sockets, and a blackened tongue, like that of a long dead man, protruded between its teeth, but otherwise it was clean of flesh, and the bones glittered whitely in the sun as it came onward. The chamberlains were mute before it, and there was no sound except the golden creaking of their girdles, the shrill rustling of their silks as they shook and trembled, and the footbones of the skeleton clicked sharply on the pavement of black onyx as it paused, and the putrefying tongue began to quiver between its teeth, and it uttered these words in an unctuous, nauseous voice. Return and tell the Emperor Zotola that Namira, seer and magician, has come to dwell beside him. Hearing the skeleton speak as if it had been a living man, and hearing the dread name of Namira, as men hear the tocsin of doom in some fallen city, the chamberlains could stand before it no longer, and they fled with ungainly swiftness and bore the message to Zotola. Learning who it was that had come to neighbor with him in Umaos, the emperor's wrath died out like a feeble and blustering flame on which the wind of darkness had blown. And the venous purple of his cheeks was mottled with a strange pallor, and he said nothing. But his lips mumbled loosely, as if in prayer or malediction, and the news of Namira's coming passed like the flight of evil night birds through all the palace and throughout the city, leaving a noisome terror that abode in Umaos thereafter till the end. For Namira, through the black renown of his thaumaturgies and the frightful entities who served him, had become a power that no secular sovereign dared dispute, and men feared him everywhere, even as they feared the gigantic shadowy lords of hell and of outer space. And in Umaos, people said that he had come on the desert wind from Tasu'un with his underlings, even as the pestilence comes, and had reared his house in an hour with the aid of devils beside Zotola's palace. And they said that the foundations of the house were laid on the adamantine cope of hell, and in its floors were pits at whose bottom burned the nether fires, or stars could be seen as they passed under in lowermost night. And the followers of Namira were the dead of strange kingdoms, the demons of sky and earth and abyss, and mad, impious hybrid things that the sorcerer himself had created from forbidden unions. Men shunned the neighborhood of his lordly house, and in the palace of Zotola, few cared to approach the windows and balconies that gave thereon. And the emperor himself spoke not of Namira, pretending to ignore the intruder. And the women of the harem babbled evermore with an evil gossip concerning Namira and his concubines. But the sorcerer himself was not beheld by the people of the city. Some believed that he walked forth at will, clad with invisibility. His servitors likewise were not seen, but a howling as of the damned was sometimes heard to issue from his portals. And sometimes there came a stony cachinnation, as though some adamantine image had laughed aloud. And sometimes there was a chuckling like the sound of shattered ice in a frozen hill. Dim shadows moved in the porticos when there was neither sunlight nor lamp to cast them. And red, eerie lights appeared and vanished in the windows at eve, like a blinking of demoniac eyes. And slowly the ember-colored suns went over Xylac and were quenched in far seas, and the ashy moons were blackened as they fell nightly toward the hidden gulf. Then, seeing that the wizard had wrought no open evil and that none had endured palpable harm from his presence, the people took heart, and Xotola drank deeply and feasted in oblivious luxury as before. And dark Phasidon, prince of all turpitudes, was the true but never acknowledged lord of Xylac. And in time, the men of Umaos bragged little of Namira and his dread thaumaturgies, even as they had boasted of the purple sins of Xotola. But Namira, still unbeheld by living men and living women, sat in the inner halls of that house which his devils had reared for him, and spun over and over in his thoughts the black web of revenge. And in all Umaos there was none, even among his fellow beggars, who recalled the beggar boy, Narthos, and the wrong done by Xotola to Narthos in old time was the least of those cruelties which the emperor had forgotten. When the fears of Xotola were somewhat lulled, and his women gossiped less often of the neighboring wizard, there occurred a new wonder and a fresh terror. For, sitting one eve at his banquet table with his courtiers about him, the emperor heard a noise as of myriad iron-shod hooves that came trampling through the palace gardens. And the courtiers also heard the sound and were startled amid their mounting drunkenness. And the emperor was angered, and he sent certain of his guards to examine into the cause of the trampling. But peering forth upon the moon-bright lawns and parterres, the guards beheld no visible shape, though the loud sounds of trampling still went to and fro. It seemed as if a rout of wild stallions passed and repassed before the facade of the palace with tumultuous gallopings and capricoles. And fear came upon the guards as they looked and listened, and they dared not venture forth, but returned to Xotola, and And the emperor himself grew sober when he heard their tale, and he went forth with high blusterings to view the prodigy. And all night the unseen hooves rang out sonorously on the pavements of onyx, and ran with deep thuddings over the grasses and flowers. The palm fronds waved on the windless air as if parted by racing steeds, and visibly the tall stemmed lilies and broad-petaled exotic blossoms were trodden under, and rage and terror nested together in Zotola's heart as he stood in a balcony above the garden, hearing the spectral tumult and beholding the harm done to his rarest flower beds. The women, the courtiers and eunuchs cowered behind him, and there was no slumber for any occupant of the palace, but toward dawn the clamor of hooves departed, going toward Namira's house. When the dawn was full grown above Umaos, the emperor walked forth with his guards about him, and saw that the crushed grasses and broken down stems were blackened as if by fire where the hooves had fallen. Plainly were the marks imprinted like the tracks of a great company of horses in all the lawns and parterres, but they ceased at the verge of the gardens, and though everyone believed that the visitation had come from Namira, there was no proof of this in the grounds that fronted the sorcerer's abode, for here the turf was untrodden. "A pox upon Namira if he has done this," cried Zotola. "For what harm have I ever done to him? Verily I shall set my heel on the dog's neck, and the torture wheel shall serve him, even as these horses from hell have served my blood-red lilies of Sotar, and my vein-colored irises of Naat, and my orchids from Ukastrog, which were purple as the bruises of love. Yea, though he stand the viceroy of Thassidon above earth, and overlord of 10,000 devils, my wheel shall break him, and fires shall heat the wheel white hot in its turning, till he withers black as the seared blossoms." Thus did Zotola make his brag, but he issued no orders for the execution of the threat, and no man stirred from the palace toward Namira's house, and from the portals of the wizard none came forth. Or, if any came, there was no visible sign or sound. So the day went over, and the night rose, bringing later a moon that was slightly darkened at the rim. And the night was silent, and Zotola, sitting long at the banquet table, drained his wine cup often and wrathfully, muttering new threats against Namira. And the night wore on, and it seemed that the visitation would not be repeated. But at midnight, lying in his chamber with Obexa and fathom deep in slumber from his wine, Zotola was awakened by a monstrous clangor of hooves that raced and capered in the palace porticos and in the long balconies. All night the hooves thundered back and forth, echoing awfully in the vaulted stone, while Zotola and Obexa, listening, huddled close amid their cushions and coverlets, and all the occupants of the palace, wakeful and fearful, heard the noise, but stirred not from their chambers. A little before dawn, the hooves departed suddenly, and afterward, by day, their marks were found on the marble flags of the porches and balconies, and the marks were countless, deep graven, and black as if branded there by flame. Like mottled marble were the emperor's cheeks when he saw the hoof-printed floors, and terror stayed with him henceforward, following him to the depths of his inebriety, since he knew not where the haunting would cease. His women muttered and some wished to flee from Umaos, and it seemed that the revels of the day and evening were shadowed by ill wings that left their umbrage in the yellow wind and bedimmed the aureate amps of the lamps. And again, toward midnight, the slumber of Zotello was broken by the hooves which came galloping and pacing on the palace roof and through all the corridors and halls. Thereafter, till dawn, the hooves filled the palace with their iron clatterings, and they rang hollowly on the topmost domes, as if the coursers of gods had trodden there, passing from heaven to heaven in tumultuous cavalcade. Zotella and Obexa lying together, while the terrible hooves went to and fro in the hall outside their chamber, had no thought or heart for sin, nor could they find any comfort in their nearness. In the gray hour before dawn, they heard a great thundering high on the barred brazen door of the room, as if some mighty stallion, rearing, had drummed there with his forefeet. And soon after this, the hoofs went away, leaving a silence like an interlude in some gathering storm of doom. Later, the marks of the hooves were found everywhere in the halls, marring the bright mosaics. Black holes were burnt in the golden threaded rugs and the rugs of silver and scarlet, and the high white domes were pitted poxwise with the marks, and far up on the brazen door of Zotella's chamber, the prints of a horse's forefeet were incised deeply. In Umaos and throughout Xylac, the tale of this haunting became known, and the thing was deemed an ominous prodigy, though people differed in their interpretations. Some held that the sending came from Namira and was meant as a token of his supremacy above all kings and emperors, and some thought that it came from a new wizard who had risen in Tinarath, far to the east, and who wished to supplant Namira. And the priests of the gods of Xylac held that their various deities had dispatched the haunting as a sign that more sacrifices were required in the temples. Then in his hall of audience, whose floor of sard and jasper had been grievously pocked by the unseen hooves, Zotella called together many priests and magicians and soothsayers and asked them to declare the cause of the sending and devise a mode of exorcism. But seeing that there was no agreement among them, Zotella provided the several priestly sects with the wherewithal of sacrifice to their sundry gods. And the wizards and prophets were sent away under threat of decapitation if they refused. They were enjoined to visit Namira in his mansion of sorcery and learn at his will if haply the sending were his and not the work of another. Loath were the wizards and the soothsayers, fearing Namira and caring not to intrude upon the frightful mysteries of his obscure mansion. But the swordsmen of the emperor